Hello, welcome to Foreign Entanglements. I'm Matt Duss. I'm with the Center for American Progress and a columnist at the American Prospect magazine. With me today for the first time is Gisu Nia. She's the executive director of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. She's an international lawyer who's done work on human rights issues with the Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia and the ICC. Welcome, Gisu.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. We met a few weeks ago for the first time and discussed some of the issues ongoing in Iran, relating to human rights. So really glad you could be on with us today. I mean, I think there's a lot of talk, a lot of attention in the U.S. On the nuclear talks, which I think, surprising a lot of people, are going fairly well by most accounts. But there has been concern expressed by the human rights community that human rights issues in Iran, could be overshadowed. So I just wanted to kind of discuss the situation with you. You could bring up some of the key issues that you're looking at right now. So why don't we start? Why don't you just, give a brief overview, if you could, on how the human rights situation has changed or not changed since the election of Hassan Rouhani almost a year ago now.
Well, since Rouhani was inaugurated in August, there was this enormous amount of optimism, I think, surrounding him coming to office, because on the campaign trail, he had spoken about releasing political prisoners, about increasing cultural freedoms and improving freedom of the press. But unfortunately, whether it has been due to the restrictions of his office and the limitations on his powers and just the ongoing power struggle in the country between more reformist-leaning elements and conservative hardliners who populate unelected, unaccountable bodies in the Iranian government, we haven't seen a lot of progress on those promises. I would say that there's been no net improvement among human rights indicators. Where there has been rhetoric, calling for change, calling for women's equality, as Rouhani did at a conference just a week or so ago. With all that talk, unfortunately, we have not yet seen a lot of real progress on the indicators that we were hoping we would see some change.
So what do you think is going on here? Is it that, do you think Rouhani is genuine in his beliefs about the need to reform some of Iran's human rights practices, and it's just that he's being prevented, or that it seems clear from my reading of the situation is that the supreme leader, who's kind of the final decision maker in Iran, has empowered Rouhani and his administration basically on one issue, and that's the economic issue, which is related to sanctions, getting a nuclear agreement that can get rid of some of these economic sanctions and improve Iran's economy. And he's very carefully preventing Rouhani from moving out of that, moving beyond that portfolio into some of these other domestic issues. Does that sound right?
Well, I think what we've seen, indeed, the supreme leader has authorized Rouhani and his team, most prominently Foreign Minister Zarif, to negotiate on the nuclear file and to get sanctions relief. However, one thing that the human rights community was looking to is that, for some time since Rouhani was inaugurated, we have wondered whether or not him and his administration have a true commitment to change. Mm-hmm. There were promises made on the campaign trail, and then somebody like his cultural minister, Janati, has talked about lifting the restrictions on Facebook and Twitter. He's spoken a lot about improving cultural freedoms. He's gone on Al Jazeera English and spoken about this and how Iran needs to reform. But one thing that was really troubling is that last month there was a raid on Ward 350 in Evin prison in Tehran. Ward 350 is a ward in which a lot of political prisoners are kept, and some very high-profile prisoners like Mohammed Sadegh Kaboutvand, who's a Kurdish journalist, people like Abdel Fattah Soltani, who's a human rights lawyer who worked with the Nobel laureate Shirin Ebadi to provide legal aid to marginalized members of society, and so on. And a lot of these individuals were injured, and then in a raid that happened with agents from the intelligence ministry and the Revolutionary Guard coming in and storming the ward, and they were later admitted to hospital for facial lacerations, internal injuries. One activist was reported to have broken his neck in the raid. And then they were put in isolation, and a lot of their heads were shaved and their facial hair was shaved off forcibly. So in the wake of that, we actually had a situation in which Rouhani made no public statement. He did not address what happened. And that was of great concern, because people in his cabinet, like the Minister of Justice, poor Mohammadi, came out and said that, you know, this was just a routine raid, and that, you know,
a routine raid, he said.
Indeed. And in reality, according to numerous reports, independently corroborated reports that we've received, as well as photographic evidence, this was one of the worst attacks on a political prisoner of war in 20 years. So the fact that, you know, Rouhani's silence is deafening on this issue, it's of great concern, because up until now, you know, one could have ascribed the lack of movement on human rights and so on to simply his inability to get things done, or that there was a greater priority elsewhere. And, you know, in a factoring of it, he was putting his weight elsewhere. But now with this, you know, it's a really concerning development that by omission, I mean, he hasn't said anything about what has happened.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, that last point's a very good one. I mean, trying to determine the reasons for Rouhani's lack of you know, even speaking out on something like this. I mean, not to draw an inappropriate comparison, but I think there is, it is worth making a comparison to someone like Obama, who was elected with, you know, and, you know, there were great hopes when he came into office, and, you know, he's found, or his administration has found, or and we've seen that, you know, it's a question of, okay, how much value, or how much weight do you want to place on these various things that you can or can't accomplish? So, I mean, I guess it comes down to a question of how committed do you think Rouhani is personally to some of this? I mean, I think the criticism that he's not a genuine reformer seems to me right. I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, I think you called to him like a more reformist leaning person. He was definitely the most reformist leaning and most moderate among the choices last year during the election. But the fact is, he is a regime insider of long standing, which is precisely why he has been empowered by the supreme leader. But it really comes down to, how do you think, if he's able to get a deal on the if he's able to get a nuclear deal and able to go back to the people of Iran, to the government of Iran, to the regime, and say, listen, I've had this great victory. I've secured Iran's nuclear rights. I've started to get rid of some of these sanctions. Do you think he has the interest, or if he has the interest, will he have the ability to move on some of these on human rights reform issues?
You know, I think one thing that has been said as these nuclear negotiations have been ongoing is that, and by different analysts that fall on different sides of the issue, is that if we reach a nuclear deal, which I'm certainly hoping that we do and that we have a peaceful resolution of that issue, that if we reach a nuclear deal, then is the time to discuss human rights. And I think that's been something that has also been echoed in Iranian leadership circles, something to that effect, right? I don't think the conventional wisdom would prove that out. We do have a long track record of the Iranian leadership's movements, particularly at multilateral institutions. You know, at the moment, we have a UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Iran, who is specifically mandated to assess the human rights situation in the country. And his mandate was just renewed for another year by the UN Human Rights Council back in March. But the Iranian leadership has killed a mandate before. There was a UN mandate holder, a UN special expert, whose mandate was killed in the early 2000s. And actually, Foreign Minister Zarif had a role in that. And so they're very well versed in how to negotiate at the multilateral institutions, and they've been down this path before. So similar to during the Khatami period, when there were reforms in media and a flourishing of NGOs and so on, you know, that change was not sustainable. As soon as international engagement on the issue waned, and as soon as it was not a priority, then you saw that there was a crackdown and NGOs were dismantled. And particularly during President Ahmadinejad's tenure, you saw a lot of that. So I don't think we have any historical precedent to show that if, you know, that human rights, that discussing human rights would somehow endanger what is happening currently, and that it should be shelved to a later moment at which we would see results. I don't think anything historically bears that out. And I actually do think it's not a human rights leaning and human rights informed analysis based on the calculations that the Iranian leadership has made in the past and that we've seen over the past two decades.
Right. No, I think that's, I agree with that view, but I think, at least as I've seen the debate occur, it's less, I've seen fewer people arguing that we should not talk about human rights at all and we'll just get to them later. What I have seen, and this is where, I mean, and this is where the position that I find myself in is, okay, let's talk about human rights. There's a whole range of issues that we have with Iran. There's a whole range of things on which we want to see Iran's behavior change. Human rights is one of them. Support for terrorism is another. I mean, and I wrote this in a piece for The Prospect a few months ago when there was a seizure of Iranian arms or alleged Iranian arms bound for Gaza, which was, okay, let's, you know, to paraphrase Yitzhak Rabin, let's pressure Iran on terrorism as if there were no nuclear talks, and let's try to get a nuclear deal as if there were no terrorism. It's just a question of, you know, not anchoring one of these issues to the other. Okay, let's keep focused on the nuclear deal and see if we can get agreement on that. That doesn't mean if and when we get a nuclear deal that all of our problems with Iran are gone. We still have issues on human rights. We still have issues on terrorism. But it's also, let's not complicate even more what is already a very, very complicated negotiation. Do you see the distinction I'm making?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing should, if I can say, you know, I don't think that human rights benchmarks should be a precondition for a nuclear deal. That's definitely not my position. I do know that some human rights advocates have come out and made that claim. That is definitely not our ask. And I don't think it's the ask of most leading human rights experts in the field. The ask is more that we simply not lose the focus. Very much as you say, these are two separate portfolios. There's nuclear portfolio and the human rights portfolio. What we don't want to see is that there's any kind of horse trading, so to speak, between these two portfolios. Right. So it shouldn't be that for the sake of reaching a nuclear deal, that certain ongoing concerns that the international community has about the Iranian leadership's treatment of its citizens, that just goes to the wayside, you know? So, I think we are seeing some positive shifts in that regard. You know, you and I had a discussion a few months back, and I was noting that, you know, I was very concerned by the fact that a lot of European corporations were heading over to Iran to re-engage financially, and that this wasn't being tied to any, you know, ongoing conversation about human rights concerns and that sort of thing. And I think we've already seen a shift just in the past 2 months, and it's largely been through discussion of these issues and things that have been raised at the Human Rights Council in March and in the lead up to it. One of those is that EU foreign policy chief Catherine Ashton went to Tehran. She met with the mother of a blogger who had been allegedly tortured and had died in custody in Tehran. And she met with, you know, women's rights activists and had a conversation. So she did focus on human rights as part of her visit there. And then we saw that at the end of just in this past 2 months, that the European Parliament passed a resolution emphasizing the need for human rights reform in Iran. So I think that we've even seen a shift over the past couple of months where, the P5+1 powers and other stakeholders are reassuring in that they will be raising human rights concerns and that that issue is not going to go anywhere. And I should mention, you know, one of the chief criticisms of the international community bringing human rights benchmarks to Iran, you know, one of the criticisms from the Iranian leadership has been that this is all politicized. So one thing that the Iranian leadership is want to say, and that a lot of other countries that are the subject of country-specific resolutions at the UN and so on say in defense, is, well, this is all politicized, and this is very much a Western demand, or, you know, this is only about politics, and it's actually a pretext for something else. I would argue that if all of a sudden human rights, you know, after the past 4 years, the fact that human rights has been an ongoing concern and something that's raised at multilateral institutions and at international conferences and in that level of international engagement, if all of a sudden the human rights issue went away, then I actually think it gives more credit to what the Iranian leadership is saying, that this is politicized. That,
that it's just an instrument we've been using to pressure.
Exactly. If all of a sudden it's no longer a principal concern. So So I would say, you know, human rights should not be a precondition of the nuclear deal. That is a separate track. And I'm very heartened by what I see there and the fact that there will be a peaceful resolution of that issue that will bring sanctions relief to the Iranian people. But, you know, these are two different things and we need to treat them separately, but with the same level of priority and concern.
I think there's two things that raises for me. One is, it seems, you know, looking at the way that this issue that the, you know, and frankly, I think the Obama administration never got as much credit as it deserved for really pushing and lobbying pretty hard for the creation of the special rapporteur back in, was that 2011?
Yeah.
And raising this issue in the Human Rights Council. I mean, the UN gets a lot of criticism, and certainly the UN deserves a lot of that criticism. It's a large, unwieldy, inefficient body. But, you know, discussing these issues in that venue, it seems to me that using it to continue to address this issue, as you noted just now, I mean, that's, you know, that's a success, I think, of the multilateral system and the UN in particular. It's not as smashing a success as we might like to see. But I think, you know, for the United States and the Obama administration in particular to kind of address, you know, the nuclear issue through the P5+1, to engage in those talks, but at the same time to engage on the human rights issues through the United Nations Human Rights Council, as it has done. Again, the movement is slow, but I mean, I think the things that you just noted, those are very important.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of observers who sort of don't put any stock into the United Nations at this point and say it's largely an ineffectual body. But I'm a firm believer in the importance of the multilateral institutions and the import that these UN resolutions do have, and something like the creation of the mandate of the special rapporteur. You know, one thing to remember here is that the Iranian government is very concerned about its international image. And in fact, just 2 weeks ago, Iran was elected to some UN subsidiary bodies in UN ECOSOC elections that happened about 2 weeks ago. And they were elected onto the NGO committee, which is a 19-member body that is actually quite powerful because they regulate, they're the gatekeeper of all NGO involvement at UN ECOSOC. And they were also voted onto the Commission on the Status of Women. So, you know, they're very concerned in terms of keeping a role within the UN system, and that is why something like the creation of the UNSR's mandate is so important. But it's also why, you know, powers with influence actors like the United States, the EU countries, and so on, people who had a real stake in that mandate and who played a huge role in actually getting it passed, they need to continuously support the UNSR publicly as well. I mean, the Iranian leadership has really gone out of its way to discredit Ahmed Shaheed, the mandate holder, and say that he's politicized or he's beholden to Western interests and that, you know, he doesn't actually know what's going on inside the country because he hasn't visited the country, even though they're the ones that haven't given him the permission to visit and conduct field investigations. So there's been a huge campaign to discredit him. And I think, you know, in dealing with these mechanisms, we want to just make sure that we don't lose the mandate, that we don't lose the mandate of the UN Special Rapporteur, that we don't have a situation in which support for these resolutions, both at the UN General Assembly and at the UN Human Rights Council, just sort of falls away. This year, we lost five yes votes in the net count. We lost five yes votes for the renewal of his mandate in March. So we held the line, but, you know, that is a loss. And that's a loss that's largely due, I would say, to this belief that because Rouhani has been elected, that there has been significant human rights improvements in Iran, which is actually not reflective of the case on the ground. So that sort of sustained focus will be very important moving ahead, because before the Iranian government has actually committed to meeting some human rights benchmarks that have been set on it via the UN process and through other mechanisms, we can't lose mechanisms or have them fall away before we see progress on those tracks.
You know, let me back up a little bit here to something you just said. I just kind of want to push a little bit. I mean, if we call the United Nations ineffectual, and yes, I'll grant it is, as I said, it is, you know, unwieldy in a lot of ways. But I mean, let's look at this specific human rights issue. I mean, and if we say if it's ineffectual, like compared to what, right? I mean, is there, it seems to me, as you said, Iran puts a lot of stock in its international image. And, you know, rather than just, you know, the U.S. president or U.S. secretary of state or various, you know, U.S. leaders standing up in Washington or wherever and condemning Iranian human rights abuses, it seems that it's much, much more impactful to work through the UN and have the United Nations speak for the international consensus, which is what the creation of the UN Special Rapporteur, you know, essentially symbolizes. This is the international community saying to Iran, you have a human rights problem. We're going to investigate your human rights problem. So, I mean, it seems that you know, even with all its inefficiencies, that seems like a pretty effective use of the UN right there.
Well, you know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, calling the UN ineffectual, clearly not my words, and I don't agree with it. You know, I mean, we work with the UN system. Just at this NGO, we definitely take a leading role and partner with other Iran human rights focused NGOs and also global organizations to try to engage with these systems and try to really engage the Iranian leadership on this as well. Yeah. So I completely agree with you, and I also think it's a real mistake for the process to be characterized as something that is a Western demand. I mean, we're talking about the United Nations, where there's many emerging powers that also have a real stake in this. The countries that we met with to discuss the resolutions included many member states in Africa, in Latin America, South America, and in Asia, all of whom echoed a lot of the concerns that we have about Iran's rising execution rate, about the treatment of women under the laws, about the treatment of religious and ethnic minorities. So, you know, in terms of there being an international consensus, I think it's very correct to say that this issue is one of international concern, and that global powers, emerging global global powers in the South, like Brazil, for instance, have taken a leading role on. So it's not accurate to say that it's a Western construct. I think that's very much something that the Iranian leadership says, but it also ignores the fact that these demands are those that are really coming from indigenous Iranian civil society.
Yeah.
There are long, you know, Iran has a very vibrant civil society. It is true that a lot of the NGOs that operated domestically, a lot of independent NGOs were dismantled over the course of Ahmadinejad's presidency over that 8 years. But, you know, a lot of people are operating, continue to operate inside the country, albeit a bit more in a clandestine manner, and also outside the country. I mean, Iranians are incredibly connected online, and so a lot of that discourse and a lot of the movement around social justice and social issues actually happens in the online space. So this is very much a demand from the Iranian people. The reason that Rouhani was elected was, of course, principally because of economic concerns and because the populace wants a lifting of sanctions and a resolution mm-hmm. of the nuclear issue. But he was also elected on a human rights mandate. The reformists put their weight behind Rouhani, and Arif, the reformist presidential candidate, dropped out at the last minute before the vote because this was all a very carefully orchestrated plan to have Rouhani be the victor. But he came into office because of the support of the reformists, and the reformists are demanding social change. So,
as we get toward the end here, I want to just discuss some possible models for what, looking at historical examples of agreements kind of like the Iran nuclear agreement. And the one I'm thinking of specifically is the Helsinki agreement, which offered security guarantees. But, you know, and a lot of conservatives, a lot of, you know, Cold War hawks in the U.S. really criticized, saying that, you know, the United States had just given away the store to the Soviet Union. But in retrospect, I think everyone recognizes now that it created a system that enabled a lot of human rights activists in the Soviet Union and Soviet satellite countries. It helped create space for their activism. But at the same time, when I'm thinking about that model, and it's not me, but others have raised this idea as well, some sort of Helsinki process with Iran, the supreme leader himself is known to be, or it's been reported, that he's kind of obsessed with the Velvet Revolutions and the end of the Soviet Union, and being very careful about, whatever the modern, the 21st century equivalent of letting blue jeans into Iran would be. The kind of cult, understanding that, cultural exchange is kind of the thin edge of the wedge, and once you start that, you're in danger of kind of creating the political space that, in his view, could essentially topple the regime. So, I mean, what, say we get, the best case scenario, we get a nuclear agreement, the P5 plus one is happy, Iran is satisfied, what then? What steps should the United States and its partners take to address the human rights issue?
One thing that we have asked for is simply that the P5 plus one powers and other global leaders not shy away from making public statements mm-hmm. that, just in this past 2 weeks, we've seen that Mir Hossein Mousavi, the opposition figure who was a presidential candidate in June 2009 in that disputed presidential election, that he was admitted to hospital for heart surgery and that he's in deteriorating health. You know, these three opposition figures, him, his wife Zahra Rahnavard, and Mehdi Karoubi have not been released from their house arrest, and it's been more than 3 years because they were put under house arrest February 14th, 2011. So, I'd like to see more public statements to that effect so that, calling for their release. I think we've seen a bit of that, but certainly not losing the focus. I don't know, the Helsinki model has been something that has been guiding, I think, for all of us looking to how human rights can be incorporated into engagement with the Iranian leadership moving forward. I do think that there's a lot of factors here that are distinct in that, not just from that, but just in terms of the waves of reform that have come to Iran before. One core factor is the level of online engagement. I think it would be, a miscalculation on the Iranian leadership's part to think that influence online, you know, that just simply filtering websites and slowing the internet down to a crawl, it's not preventing people from getting online access, being exposed to ideas, and people inside the country, particularly the youth, because more than around 70% of the country is under the age of 35. For the youth to be taking to those platforms and creating a space for discussion of civil reforms and what course their country is going to take. So they've been, the Iranian leadership has been aware of that. But what we could, you know, we in terms of what the international community can do is to make sure that those tech tools are available. So I think there's been a lot of steps that have been taken in that regard in terms of making sure that, you know, the effect of sanctions didn't hinder tech tools and other kind of telecom tools that Iranians inside the country could use. And being very supportive of Iranians being able to have that space for internal discourse is really important. So just making sure that any foreign policy decisions when it comes to the nuclear issue and geostrategic concerns don't then have an impact on human rights, whether it's down to, you know, different telecom tools being restricted. Something like now with even corporations have a role, because now, the viewers might have heard that Yahoo Mail is now, Iranians are not allowed to create Yahoo Mail accounts. And that's a Yahoo company policy, you know, so just little things like that to make sure that we can provide the resources and the tools for people in country to be able to have a discourse and be able to move progress. Also, we should not, the international community should not be dissuaded by claims from the Supreme Leader about, you know, sensitivity to Velvet Revolution and sensitivity to external factors. We're an increasingly interconnected world. And so that sort of model is very outdated. This idea that, you know, if there's change brought about inside the country, that it has to be somehow an aim of the West is, first of all, insulting to Iranians and Iranian change makers who are really pushing forward for these reforms domestically. But it's also a very outdated worldview. Let's not forget the Supreme Leader is not a young guy. So he's a regime ideologue. He's operating in the constructs of 1979 and what happened, you know, more than, 35 years ago. So he's not, I don't think he's operating in the context of what is now our interconnected world and how these sort of alliances are not very clear anymore. There's blurry lines. People are inspired in different ways that have nothing to do with a sort of East-West dichotomy. And it's just a matter of time before things change, whether, you know, through a gradual process, through Iranians inside the country being able to claim more civic space and for certain ideas taking root that the leadership cannot ignore and that they're going to have to accommodate if they want to keep the status quo.
No, that's a great, great point. And a great point for us to end on. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning. It was really, really interesting.
Okay, thank you, Matt.
All right, look forward to talking again.
Definitely.